is that between when you place an order and when you receive it, there's typically some lead time that intervenes, and during that lead time, the demand that you experience is random, and so you need inventory in order to buffer against that. But even if there's no lead time, even if there is no random demand, there are still reasons to hold inventory. For example, economies of scale, if you order in bulk, there are savings from that. There may be concerns about future availability. You want to buy product now because it may not be available in the future. Prices might be lower now than they'll be in the future, and so on. There's, of course, lots of things you could add to this list. I'm just including a couple examples here. On the other hand, inventory is expensive. The main reason inventory is expensive is that you have capital tied up in that inventory. So, you know, if capital costs you 25 or 30% a year, then that's a lot of money that's tied up in inventory if you don't manage it well. And there are other reasons that inventory is something that companies try to avoid. For example, they may have limited shelf space and they simply can't hold that much inventory. The inventory might be perishable so that they can't hold it for too long. There might be some risk of theft or fire or whatever bad things might happen in the warehouse. Slide 5. Inventory theory is a pretty old theory, and there's lots and lots and lots of literature out there. And this literature has, you know, we need ways of classifying the models that come across in this literature. So, I mean, this is a long list of ways that inventory models can be classified. Probably the most important is whether the demand is deterministic or stochastic. Of course, there are other things that can be stochastic, like prices or supply and that sort of thing. But historically, most of the models either assume that everything is deterministic or they assume that the demand is stochastic, although in the past, maybe 10 years, that started to change where there are new models that look at stochastic supply and that sort of thing. Single versus multi-echelon, as I said, I'll talk a little bit about single-echelon or single-stage models in this talk and then talk about multi-echelon models. Periodic versus continuous review means how often does the inventory system monitor itself and place orders. If it's periodic review, then the system looks at, let's say, every day or every week or every month, evaluates the current inventory level and places an order if necessary. In a continuous review system, the system is continuously monitored, and whenever the inventory level reaches some target, some trigger point, then an order is placed. Demand can be modeled as discrete, like Poisson demand, or continuous, like normal demand. Another important difference is the difference between back orders and lost sales. If a demand occurs in an inventory system and there isn't enough inventory to satisfy the demand, then the question is what happens to that demand. If we assume that the demand is back ordered, it means that the demand is willing to wait until the inventory is available, and presumably there's some cost that gets incurred when that happens. But that basically is treated almost like a negative inventory, and when positive inventory arrives, then it replenishes that back order. And the other case is lost sales, which means the customer just says, okay, if you don't have the product that I want to buy, I'll just go to your competitor down the street and buy it there. So when that happens, the demand arrives, and then it just disappears if you can't meet the demand from stock. Global versus local control has to do with whether each location in a multi-echelon inventory system has information about the other echelons, the other stages, or whether they only have information about themselves that they have to use when they make ordering decisions. Centralized versus decentralized refers to whether the system is, whether you're trying to minimize the cost or maximize the profit of the whole system, or whether each party in the system is trying to optimize its own cost or profit. Fixed cost versus no fixed cost is really a modeling issue. Models tend to be much harder if there's a fixed cost to place an order. Like, for example, you have to pay $1,000 to rent the truck to ship the product from your supplier to you, and it's a fixed cost, meaning if you put, you know, 1 pound or 40,000 pounds on the truck, you still pay the same fixed cost. And lead time versus no lead time refers to whether product arrives instantaneously when you order it or only after some time intervenes. Now, of course, for most of these distinctions, you know, real-life systems don't fall neatly into any of these two buckets. I mean, most systems, for example, probably encounter some combination of back orders and lost sales. It's probably never realistic to assume that there's actually zero fixed cost or zero lead time. But, like any model, you know, we sometimes make approximations because it leads to mathematical tractability, and when we do it, we hope that it's not costing us too much in terms of the realism of the model. Okay, moving on to slide 6. These are the typical costs that are included in inventory models, and probably if you've studied inventory models before, then these are familiar to you. There's a cost to have, let's say, positive inventory. That's called the holding cost, and that refers to the cost of capital, the risk of spoilage, the risk of theft, and so on. And that's usually expressed in terms of dollars per item per unit time. So if I hold more items, then I pay more holding costs, and if I hold those items for longer time, then I pay more holding costs. And the counterpart to holding cost is the stockout penalty. If I incur back orders, as I'll usually assume in these models, rather than lost sales, then that's treated, as I said, like negative inventory. And that incurs a cost of P per item and, again, per unit time. So if your demand is back ordered for a week, it costs you seven times as much as if your demand is only back ordered for a day. If there's a fixed cost, we'll denote it by K, and that's expressed as dollars per order. It's independent of the order quantity. But we pay a cost of little c per item that we order, although in many inventory optimization models, we ignore the cost c because under some assumptions, the total number of units that you purchase, let's say in a year, is constant. It's independent of the optimization that you do, and therefore the total purchase cost is just c times the number of units that you order in a year, and nothing that you do in the optimization problem is going to change that. In other words, that cost is a constant, and it often gets ignored in optimization models. Slide 7 gives a brief history of inventory theory, and I really do mean brief. I mean, this is a huge body of literature, and I just tried to point out some of what I think are the seminal models, the seminal papers, and most of these are models that I'll talk about briefly today. Probably the most famous inventory model is the EOQ model, which is from Harris in 1913.
After the tone, please state your name, followed by the pound sign.
Abdul?
There are 20 parties in conference, including you.
55 when it started, when I found the sources that referred to it. In 1958, Wagner and Witten introduced what's now known as the Wagner-Witten model, in which we have demands that vary over time, but they vary deterministically. So the question there is, what periods should you place orders, and how big should those orders be? In 1960, Clark and Scarf introduced a model and an algorithm for solving serial stochastic systems. So I'll tell you later on what a serial system is, but it's basically like a path or a chain in graph theory. And these are models with stochastic demands, and this was the first paper that was able to solve multi-echelon models with stochastic demands. Another important paper is by Robin Roundy in 1985, and this has become sort of a famous paper. To be honest, it's probably not super practical, but it is very widely used in the academic literature, and basically he looked at serial systems with deterministic demand but fixed costs, and those turn out to be very, very hard systems, and he introduced a type of policy called a power of two policy, which is heuristic but performs very well, and I'll talk more about both of those, Clark and Scarf and Roundy, later on in the talk. And finally, probably the most recent, what I would consider to be a big development in inventory theory, is the development of what are called guaranteed service models, and I'll talk more about those later as well. Those had been introduced prior to this paper by Graves and Willems in 2000, but it was really that paper that brought it to the attention of a lot of folks in inventory theory and supply chain. Okay, so I'm about to move on to single-stage models just to provide some information on some of the building blocks of the multi-stage models. If there are any questions, though, I can entertain those now. Okay, great. So I'm on slide 9 now. And I just want to give you, probably many of you have seen the EOQ model before, but I want to give you a quick reminder of how it works. In this model, the assumption is that the demand is continuous and deterministic at a rate of lambda per year. So for me, the easiest way to think of this is that there's just some tank full of water, let's say, and the tank is just draining constantly at a steady rate. There aren't discrete demands that are arriving and withdrawing an item from a shelf. It's like a continuously divisible product that gets drained at a continuous rate. There's a fixed cost of K to place each order and a holding cost of H per item per year, just like I showed you a couple slides ago. But in this model, stockouts are not allowed. And since the demand is deterministic, everything is deterministic, we can impose that constraint that stockouts are not allowed. Every demand has to be met from inventory. And so the picture at the bottom is kind
kind of the famous sawtooth EOQ curve, and the way that the system works is at time zero you place an order, let's call the order quantity capital Q, and then your inventory gets drained continuously over time, and when the inventory level hits zero, you place another order. I'm assuming here that the lead time is zero, but if there is a positive lead time, it's very, very easy to incorporate that, so we'll just assume that the lead time is zero. Next slide gives the average annual cost, and it's pretty easy to calculate this. The first term represents the fixed cost of placing the orders. The second term represents the holding cost of holding the inventory. This is a convex function of Q, so we can just take a first order condition and solve that for Q in order to get Q star, the optimal order quantity, which is the square root of 2K lambda over H, and that's the famous EOQ quantity. If you've studied inventory theory before, you've seen that quantity before. And one of the nice things about this model has a lot of interesting mathematical properties that I won't talk about today, but one of the nice things is that it's easy to write not only the optimal solution in closed form, but also the cost of the optimal solution, and that's square root of 2K lambda H, which is the same as H times the optimal order quantity. And one of the, inventory theorists like to get closed form answers. We like to just be able to write Q star equals when we can. There are a lot of problems in inventory theory that, you do the analysis and you get to a certain point and you say, okay, well, this now it's hard. And, for those of you who are optimization people, you would probably look at those models and laugh at me because those really aren't hard models. A lot of the time it's, let's say, some unconstrained, convex optimization problem, which is really quite easy to solve. But the reason we say it's hard is that we like to get closed form answers whenever we can without having to run an algorithm. And the reason for that is that, for one thing, it's easier to get insights out of the model to understand, for example, when some of the key parameters change, how do the solutions and costs change. But secondly, none of the models that I'm going to talk to you about today really get implemented in their exact form in practice. Really, they just serve as building blocks for bigger, more complicated models. And so it's often important in those models to be able to have closed form answers, even if they have to be approximate for the more simple models. Okay, so slide 11 is about the news vendor model. This used to be called the newsboy model, but I guess now we have to be non-gender specific, so we call it the news vendor model. And the story here is that, there's a news vendor. Every day he goes to the publisher of the newspaper and he buys some quantity of newspapers and he pays, let's say, 25 cents each for those. And then throughout the day he sells them for 75 cents each. He's not allowed to go back to the publisher later in the day to buy more newspapers, so if he runs out, then he just loses the profit on the extra that he would have been able to sell. On the other hand, if he has leftover newspapers at the end of the day, he sells them back to the publisher for, let's say, 10 cents. So he incurs some loss, but the publisher bears some of that cost as well. And so the demand is stochastic. Let's just pretend it's normally distributed with a mean of 50 and a standard deviation of 10. If he has extra inventory, extra newspapers at the end of the day, he can't hold it until tomorrow and try to sell it then. So newspapers are an example of perishable inventory. I don't mean perishable in the sense that they're going to rot or go bad, but perishable in the sense that if I don't sell it today, it has a very definite expiration date. I can't sell today's newspaper tomorrow. And also I can't, in this model, carry any back orders. If you come to my newsstand and you want today's paper, you can't, and I don't have it, I can't ask you to wait until tomorrow because tomorrow it'll be a new newspaper. So in that case, in that sense, what we are describing here is a lost sales model. And so the key question here is how many newspapers should the news vendor buy? And your intuition probably tells you that he should buy more than 50. If the mean demand is 50, he should probably buy more than that because it seems like it's more expensive to have too few than it is to have too many, so he should err on the side of having too many. But then the question is how many precisely should he buy? So on the next slide, I give a more general formulation of this model. It turns out that although I made some pretty strong assumptions on the previous slide, like only a single period and no inventory carryover and no back orders, we can relax all those assumptions and the analysis is almost the same. So in the more general formulation, we have just some periodic stochastic demand, meaning every day or every week we get an IID demand from some distribution. Let's say it has a PDF of little f and a CDF of big F. I'll assume normal distribution just because it makes my life easier, but you can do most of the same analysis for any distribution. We can assume that the inventory is perishable or non-perishable. In other words, we can assume that inventory can be carried over or not. Either way, we have some holding cost or overage cost times H. Overage cost means basically the cost of having too much. That cost can include some sort of salvage value if I'm allowed to sell the newspapers back to the publisher, for example, or some salvage cost. I mean, maybe whatever this product is, I have to pay to carry it to the dump and dispose of it there, so maybe there's some salvage cost then. Similarly, I can assume back orders or lost sales, and the analysis is almost the same. Either way, I have an underage cost, a cost of having too little of P per unit, and that underage cost can include the lost profit. It can also include loss of goodwill, which is the standard, the term that gets used to describe the fact that customers get angry when you don't have their, you don't have the product that they want, and in the long run, that's going to cost you real dollars. And there may be some administrative costs, for example, maintaining a list of back orders or something like that. And so all of those can be buried in this parameter piece. And here the decision variable, instead of calling it Q, I'll call it Y, which refers to a so-called base stock level. The policy that I'm describing here is called a base stock policy, and the way that it works is I have this target inventory level Y, and in each period I look at how much inventory I have. Of course, if this was a perishable product like newspapers, then I start each period with zero, but if it's a product that I can carry over from period to period, I might start with some positive inventory. I look at how much I have, and I just order so that I bring my inventory level up to Y. In other words, I order Y minus the amount that I currently have. That's called a base stock policy or an order up to policy. Sometimes called an S policy or an S minus one comma S policy. It has like a million names in the literature, but I'll call it a base stock policy. The next slide gives the expected cost function, and essentially this function divides the cost into two parts, the cost of having too little and the cost of having too much. The first term is the cost of having too much, and basically this calculates the expected amount by which you the expected amount of extra inventory that you have, that's the first integral, times the H, the cost of having extra inventory. And the second integral is the cost, is the expected amount by which you fall short of the demand, and that gets multiplied by P, the underage cost. And this is also a convex function of Y, so we can just solve the first order condition. To take a derivative of this, you have to use Leibniz's rule, which allows you to take derivatives of integrals, but it's not that hard. And what you find is that the optimal Y is equal to mu, the mean demand, plus sigma times phi inverse. So phi inverse is the inverse cumulative normal distribution. Phi inverse of P over P plus H. And another way of writing that is mu plus sigma times Z alpha, where alpha is P over P plus H. Now, P over P plus H is a kind of famous ratio called the newsvendor or the newsboy ratio. And this ratio crops up in a lot of inventory theory, not just in the newsvendor problem. So alpha is P over P plus H. Z alpha is the alpha is quantile of the normal distribution. And so then Y star equals mu plus sigma times Z alpha. Moving on to slide 14, that quantity, mu plus sigma times Z alpha, has a nice interpretation. In particular, the mu part, the mean demand, is called cycle stock. Cycle stock is the inventory that you keep in order to protect against just the expected demand every day. As I said, I know I'm probably going to want 50 units of 50 newspapers, and the question is how much more. So the mu is the 50 part. And then the sigma times Z alpha is the safety stock, the stock that you have to buffer you against uncertainty in demand. And that answers the how much more question. In particular, what it says is, okay, the amount that you should have on hand is the mean demand plus some number of standard deviations of extra demand. And so what this is saying is the correct number of standard deviations to have extra is Z alpha. So each day you will not stock out as long as the demand is less than your inventory level. In other words, less than mu plus sigma Z alpha. And this occurs with probability alpha. So what this is saying is that the optimal service level, and there are lots of ways to define service level, but here I just mean the percentage of days or periods when you do not have a stock out. The optimal service level is given by alpha. Of course, you can choose your service level. You could say, I'm willing to stock out on 10% of days or 1% of days, and you can set Y accordingly. But what the newsvendor model is saying is correct, the optimal percent of days to have stockouts is, or to have no stockouts is alpha. all of this has assumed a lead time of zero. In other words, I go to the publisher in the morning, I pick up my newspapers right away. If there's some positive lead time, L, then the answer is still easy. Then we multiply the cycle stock by L, and we might multiply the safety stock by the square root of L. Okay, I'm about to move on. So that gives you the fundamentals that we'll use later in the talk. Are there any questions about that before I go on to the multi-echelon section? All right, either I've lost everybody or I've kept you all with me. I hope it's the latter.
Oh, you're doing fine.
Okay. This section has three parts. I first want to just give you an overview of the terminology that we use in multi-echelon modeling, and then talk about deterministic models and then stochastic models. So this is part one on network topology. First, just to introduce some terminology, this diagram gives you a network of stages or locations or nodes or items or sites in a supply chain or an inventory network. The arrows indicate shipping, so the nodes on the left ship to the nodes in the next column, which do some processing or assembling or whatever, and then ship to the next column and so on. And each of those columns that I've drawn red boxes around, those are called echelons. So an echelon is just like a tier of the supply chain. And typically that represents some kind of, some similar function. So, you know, an echelon might be factories or warehouses or retailers or customers. Now, we model inventory in a very abstract way. I don't really care what these stages represent. They can represent physical locations, cities, factories, whatever. They can represent items or part numbers in a bill of materials, and so the arrows represent relationships in the bill of materials. For example, I need two of product one and six of product two in order to make one unit of product three, and so on. They can represent some sort of processing activities like packaging or testing or shipping or whatever. And the models that I'll talk about are really, in most cases, generic enough to handle any of those interpretations. It's probably easiest if you think about these, at least for now, think about these as physical locations, but really any of those interpretations is appropriate. Next slide, slide 17 now. The terminology in terms of describing direction in a supply chain is that the nodes that are upstream are called, the nodes that are to the left are called upstream, the nodes that are to the right are called downstream, and product moves from upstream to downstream. And in the way I'll think about it, only the most downstream stages face the customer demand, although it's, in many cases it's easy to relax that assumption. For example, it could be that the downstream stages represent a finished product, and there's demand for that product. But maybe there's also a demand for some of the raw materials. It's usually easy to accommodate that, but I generally won't in this talk. Okay, so the next slides give you examples of different types of network topologies, and I'm giving them in roughly increasing order of complexity. So slide 18, this is the most basic multi-echelon system. It's called a serial system or a series system. And in a series system, each stage has at most one predecessor and at most one successor. It just looks like a link, like a chain or a path. The next type of topology in increasing order of complexity is an assembly system on slide 19. And an assembly system is defined that each stage has at most one successor. The basic idea is you start with lots of products or locations, and then you gradually consolidate those until you have only one, or possibly more than one. But there can't be, but each stage has to have at most one successor in that case. And the opposite of an assembly system is called a distribution system, in which each stage has at most one predecessor. And the interpretation here is that we have some starting product that then gets distributed through a network. Let's say the upstream stage represents a factory, and the downstream stage represents a whole bunch of, the downstream echelon represents a whole bunch of retailers. And finally, next slide 21. Is a tree system. In a tree system, we don't have any restrictions on neighbors, like at most one successor or at most one predecessor, but we do require that there's no cycles in the graph theory sense, like a closed loop of arrows in the diagram. And finally, the most general type of system, we don't require any sort of rules about predecessors and successors, and we also don't have any restrictions on cycles. And so these are the most general and consequently the most complicated systems to analyze. Okay, so part two of the section of multi-echelon models, I'll first talk about deterministic systems, and then in part three I'll talk about stochastic systems. Now, deterministic systems are easy unless there are fixed costs. It's the fixed costs that make, for example, the EOQ model difficult, and similarly any deterministic multi-echelon system. So I will assume here that there are fixed costs. Slide 24 now. The assumptions here are that, first of all, each stage is going to operate like an EOQ system. The last stage faces the customer demand, and just like in the EOQ model, there's a sort of continuous, that gets drawn down continuously and deterministically. Every stage in the system incurs a fixed cost every time it places an order. And just like in the EOQ model, no stockouts are allowed. And although we can consider more general systems than serial systems, I'll only consider serial systems here. Okay, so here's the problem that we face at slide 25 now. We need to choose the order quantity Q at all the stages simultaneously. We, of course, the order quantity at one stage may affect the order quantity at another stage, and therefore I have to optimize those globally. I can't just optimize stage by stage. We know certain things about properties that optimal solutions to this problem have. For example, we know that every optimal, or that there exists an optimal solution that satisfies the so-called zero inventory ordering policy, or ZIO, property, which means that we only order when the inventory level hits zero. There's never any reason to order before the inventory level hits zero. We know that optimal solutions are stationary, which means that each stage has the same order quantity every time it places an order. You don't order 20 units today and 15 units tomorrow. You always order the same queue. But, of course, different stages might have different queues. And finally, we know that optimal solutions are nested. And nested means that whenever one stage orders, so does its customer. So that means that the stages that are upstream order the least frequently, and the stages that are downstream order the most frequently. We never have the case where an upstream stage orders, but the stage downstream from it, or really any of the stages downstream from it, don't place orders. And one other note here, instead of using Q as a decision variable, I'm going to use U, little lowercase u, as the decision variable. U represents the reorder interval, in other words, the time between orders. And since this is a deterministic model, Q and U have a direct relationship. U just equals Q over lambda. So optimizing one is equivalent to optimizing the other. And it just turns out to be a little bit more convenient to work with U. Okay, slide 26 gives a nonlinear programming formulation. The objective function minimizes the average cost per year, which is a function of the vector U of all the different reorder intervals. Each stage has its own reorder interval. The objective function itself is almost exactly like the EOQ function, except that I'm writing it in terms of U instead of Q, and I'm doing it for each stage and then summing them up. The first constraint says that the reorder interval at stage J has to equal theta J times the reorder interval at the next stage, stage J plus 1, and theta is required to be an integer. And this is enforcing the nested property. This is saying that if the reorder interval upstream is an integer multiple of the reorder interval at the next stage downstream, then it's a nested policy. The upstream stage, the downstream stage always orders when the upstream stage does. And then we also need to have the reorder intervals be non-negative. So this is a non-convex mixed integer NLP, non-convex because theta and u are both decision variables and they're multiplied together on the right-hand side there. And it turns out that the optimal solution u star is not known. We don't know a good algorithm for solving it. We certainly don't know a closed form solution for u star. And in fact, there's no guarantee that an optimal solution even exists. It's possible that that an optimal solution sort of only exists in the limit, but for any solution you pick, you can find an infinitesimally better solution, or an arbitrarily small better solution. So it's possible that U star doesn't even exist. So this is a hard problem, and the way that it usually gets addressed is that we find a lower bound on this problem by solving a relaxed version of the problem, and we get an upper bound on the problem by then relaxing that solution to a feasible solution. So I'll talk about the lower bound first. That comes on slide 27. In the lower bound problem, we relax the constraint that says that uj has to be an integer multiple of uj plus 1 and replace it with a constraint that just says uj has to be greater than or equal to uj plus 1. So we get rid of the integer theta variables entirely. And what we have now is just a convex NLP. And we can solve this this problem using an NLP solver. It's an easy problem, but actually there's a more efficient way of doing it. Slide 28 now. So it turns out that in order to solve this problem, what we have to do is the following. We partition all the stages in the system so that stages are in partitions that that include consecutive stages within each cluster of the partition. And we require in each partition that all of the stages have the same UJ. We'll just think of that as U. So every stage within a given cluster has to have the same reorder interval U. And it turns out that to find the optimal U for that cluster is easy. It is equivalent to solving an EOQ problem. So it's trivial. It's very easy. And that's true for any partition that you come up with. So the question is, which partition do you want to use? And the answer is that if you find the correct partition, then solving the problem in this way solves the relaxed problem. And I won't go into detail. It shouldn't be obvious why that's the case. And I won't go into detail about why that's the case. But it turns out to be true that if we pick the correct partition, then solving these separate EOQ problems gives us a solution to the relaxed problem, the lower bound problem. And now the question is, how do we find the correct partition? And the answer is, it's also easy. It's equivalent to finding the upper concave envelope of a set of points in two dimensions. So imagine just a map of points in the first quadrant of the Euclidean plane, and you just want to find the upper concave envelope of those points. And it turns out that that's an easy problem as well. That can be solved very efficiently. So solving the lower bound problem turns out to be very easy, easier than even just drawing it into an off-the-shelf NLP solver. Now the question is, how do we get an upper bound? How do we get a feasible solution? And so here's how we do it in this model. We're on slide 29 now. I first need to define a power of two policy. So let U hat be some fixed base period. U hat is just some interval of time, like a week or 3 days or whatever, and we're going to fix that unit of time. And then in a power of two policy, we require all of the I have this definition entirely wrong here. A power of two policy should say each UJ is a power of two multiple of U hat. So in other words, if U hat is 1 week, then every reorder interval has to be a power of two multiple of U hat. In other words, I'm allowed to order every week or every 2 weeks or every 4 weeks or every 8 weeks or every half week or every quarter week or every eighth of a week or every 16th of a week. We allow negative powers of two. Okay? And so why do we want a power of two policy? Well,
could you say that again, please? I'm sorry.
Sure. Say
that again?
Yeah, sure. So I should have written the equation. It would say UJ equals 2 to the n times U hat. UJ equals 2 to the n times U hat, and n can be any integer, positive, negative, or zero.
Thank you.
Okay? So UJ can be 1 week, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, one half week, one quarter week, and so on. All right? Now, you could argue that these are reasonable policies in practice. I mean, companies tend to order every week or every 2 weeks or every 4 weeks, let's say. But really the reason we do this is because it's mathematically tractable. And the next slide will give you a sense of why that is. Really, I'm going to skip all of the details of this proof. It's a non-trivial proof. But the result is this. If I find a power of two policy by taking the solution I got from the relaxed problem, the lower bound problem, taking those UJs and rounding them to the nearest power of two policy, the nearest power of two interval. Okay, so if my powers of two are, if the base period is one, so that the powers of two are just 1, 2, 4, and so on, and I get that UJ should equal 3.5, then I round it up to 4, and so on. Okay, I do that with all of the UJs, and that gives me some feasible but not optimal policy called U plus. Okay? If I do that, then the cost of U plus is no more than about 6% worse than the cost of U star. U star is the optimal policy, and remember, we don't know what this policy is. We don't have good algorithms or formulas for finding this policy. But nevertheless, there's a famous theorem by Robin Roundy in 1985 that says the cost of U plus divided by the cost of U star is no more than about 1.06. And that's true for any U hat. If I pick U hat equal to a week, or 3 days or 19 years or 4 milliseconds or whatever, it's still true that the cost of the optimal power of two policy is no more than 6% worse than the cost of the optimal policy. And if I can choose UHAT, if I can set the base period to be whatever I want, then I can, then this bound reduces even further to 1.02. So then I can be no more than about 2% worse than optimal when I pick a power of two policy. So the upshot of all of this is that although this serial system is difficult to solve exactly, we can get very good heuristics that are very, we can get a very good heuristic solution that's very easy to find and has a very nice worst case bound. Now, this model has been extended in a number of ways, for example, to assembly systems and more general multi-echelon systems. And as I said at the outset, I don't know that this model gets implemented by itself in practice all that often. In my mind, this is more of a theoretical, more of theoretical interest than anything else. And the primary reason for that is that it doesn't include uncertainty. And so that's what the next section talks about. Are there any questions before I move on to stochastic systems?
So we're on slide 31, Larry?
Slide 31.
Yeah, okay. Right. So remember, we have 60 slides, so. Okay.
Yes, I know. Don't worry, I won't keep you past.
Right.
Worst comes to worst, I will flash and burn at the end.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, slide 32 gives the assumptions of the stochastic system that I'll be modeling. Here, each stage functions like a news vendor system in the sense that the last stage in the system has periodic demand that's stochastic. We have no fixed ordering costs, just like in the news vendor model. You can extend this model to the case with fixed costs, but it's more difficult, so I won't discuss that today. And we allow both inventory carryover if there's excess inventory and back orders if there is insufficient inventory. We'll assume that each stage follows a base stock policy. Remember, that means that each stage chooses a target inventory level Y called the base stock level. Every period, they look at the current inventory level, and they order to bring their inventory level up to Y. Now, what makes this problem difficult is that there are two types of lead times in this model. The first is just called L, and that's like a deterministic transit time or travel time between two stages. That can be different for different stages, but the point is that that's a deterministic quantity, maybe zero, maybe non-zero. But that doesn't mean that when you place an order, you receive it L periods later, because there's an additional stochastic component to the lead time in the sense that when you place an order, the upstream guy from you might be out of stock. And if he's out of stock, then you also have to wait until his stock is replenished until you get the items that you ordered. So W represents the waiting time, which incorporates both types of lead times. It incorporates the transit time, the deterministic amount, plus the extra delay that might be incurred because your supplier has stockouts. So W equals L if there was no stockout when you placed your order, and W is greater than L if you had to wait because your supplier was stocked out. And it turns out that although W seems like a straightforward quantity, W is a random variable. And characterizing the distribution of that random variable is very, very difficult. And that is what makes these problems really difficult. Slide 33 now. There have been two main approaches for dealing with that difficulty. In the first, it's called stochastic service models. And the assumption there is that each stage just meets the demand whenever it can. In that case, W is equal to zero. And some of the time, the demands are just going to be backordered at a given stage, and then the downstream stage has to incur some waiting time, W that's greater than zero. Sorry, that should say W equals L and W greater than L, not W equals zero and W greater than zero. And the other type of approach that's been taken is what are called guaranteed service models. And the way these models work is a little bit peculiar at first. The idea is that every stage sets what's called a committed service time, which is a certain number of periods, and guarantees that the waiting time will equal the committed service time for every demand. So in other words, I say to you, I promise you that no matter how big an order you place, I will deliver that order to you within 5 days. Okay. Now, that seems to be an unreasonable assumption if the demand is stochastic, and that's true. And so what they have to assume in order to make that promise is that the demand is bounded. And so then the idea behind these models is, for any demand within the bound, I promise you that I will deliver this product within 5 days. And I'll talk more about both of these models in the next couple of slides. Another way to think about the distinction between the stochastic service and guaranteed service models is, let's call alpha the service level, and I'll define service level here as the percent of demands where I deliver the product within a wait time that's less than my committed service time. In a stochastic service model, basically the committed service time is zero. I'm trying to get the product to you with zero waiting time if possible. In other words, meet the demand from stock. But that can never happen all of the time, so alpha is less than one. In the guaranteed service model, I give you a committed service time that's positive, let's say 5 days, but I promise always to meet that committed service time. So this is a nice way of thinking about the distinction between the two. Let's talk about stochastic service models first. I'm on slide 35 now. The objective function for this model is pretty straightforward. I take all the stages in the system, and for each one, I calculate the holding cost times the expected amount of on-hand inventory plus the backorder cost times the expected number of backorders, and I sum that up over all the stages. But this is not an easy objective function to deal with, in the sense that the expected number of on-hand items and backorders at a given stage J depends on the base stock level at stage J, but it also depends on the base stock levels upstream. If my supplier has a low base stock level, he's going to stock out a lot, and that's going to cause me to stock out more. And so it turns out to be difficult to write out formulas for the on-hand inventory and the back orders as a function of Y. The first and most important paper that addressed this problem is the paper by Clark and Scarf in 1960, and what they do is they rewrite that function C of Y so that the system basically decomposes by stage. And so the algorithm that comes as a result of that allows you to find the YJs sequentially. I can find YJ for the last stage, and then I fix that, and I can find it for the next to last stage, and then fix those two, and find it for the next stage, and so on. In other words, we can decompose the system by stage. And this is an important result because it means that at each stage, all we have to solve is a one-variable convex minimization problem, which is easy. In fact, at the last stage, it's even easier. It's just a news vendor problem. I don't even need to do a line search or anything. And then at all the upstream stages, I do a line search. So the fact that the system can be decomposed in this way was a very important result, and this leads to an algorithm that is computationally easy. You're just solving a sequence of convex single-variable optimization problems. But it's actually very difficult to implement. In fact, I've tried to do it. It involves a lot of – the reason it's cumbersome is it involves a lot of numeric integration and expectation. And even using tools like MATLAB, which I'm reasonably conversant in, I found it very difficult to implement this algorithm. So the point is that it can be done, but it's for, you know, a manager trying to implement an algorithm like this, it could be difficult. Fortunately, though, there are good heuristics for this problem. In fact, there's a reasonably recent one by Shang and Song, that should say 2003, sorry, not 1993, where at each stage you're basically solving two news vendor problems, so closed form answers, you don't have to run any kind of algorithms or anything. And this heuristic performs quite well. Okay, let's move on to a more complicated topology. Let's move on to assembly systems in slide 36. The key fact that's known about assembly systems is that they're no harder than serial systems, because every assembly system can be reduced to an equivalent serial system, where I can solve the serial system using the Clark-Scarf algorithm and then convert that to a policy for the assembly system. And this is a famous theorem by Rosling in 1989, and it's based on something called the inventory balance principle, which is not that hard to explain, but since Ignacio reminded me that I'm running short on time, I'll skip that and move on to the next slide. Slide 37 is about distribution systems, and I will really skip this slide too, except to say that although distribution systems look like a mirror image of assembly systems, and it feels like they should be no harder than assembly systems, they turn out to be much, much, much harder. And we have exact algorithms for some special cases. We have heuristics for some special cases, and a few heuristics for the more general cases. But really, this is a significant unsolved problem in inventory optimization. Slide 38 talks briefly about some obvious extensions you might make. And the takeaway here is that the models that are tractable are sort of tractable but fragile. And then once you start changing some of the assumptions, like adding fixed costs or making the lead time stochastic, sometimes the problem retains its initial tractability, and sometimes that gets destroyed and the problem becomes much harder. And there's, as far as I can tell, no real rhyme or reason to why that's true. Okay, slide 40 talks about guaranteed service models. If you've studied inventory theory before, the stochastic service models are probably a kind of familiar concept to you, even if you haven't studied multi-echelon systems and the Clark-Scarf model and that sort of thing. But the guaranteed service model is a newer and less familiar concept. As I said, in this model, every stage promises to deliver every item demanded within a fixed number of periods called the committed service time, or CST. And in order to make that promise, the model has to assume that the demand is bounded. So one easy way of thinking about that is you just say, okay, let's say I have normal demand with a mean of mu and a standard deviation of sigma. I'll just say I'm going to have some bound of mu plus sigma times z alpha, and I'm just going to chop off the distribution at that point. And if the demand is bigger than that bound, then I just ignore it. And the z alpha helps you choose the bound in order to achieve a service level that you're interested in achieving. Now, this assumption of CST allows us to treat the waiting time W as deterministic, because now every demand gets delivered within 5 days, let's say, but actually it's equivalent to assuming that every demand gets delivered in exactly 5 days, which means that this parameter W, which caused a lot of problems in the stochastic service models, is now just a deterministic variable, a deterministic parameter, and that makes things a lot easier. As I said, this concept has... is there a question? No, I guess not. This concept has existed in the literature for a while, but it really in the past, since 2000, it's gained a lot more attention in the inventory and supply chain literature. Okay, so the key concept in this model is called the net lead time, and here's how it works. The assumption is that every stage has a processing time called T and a committed service time called S. So the way you read this diagram is that stage one promises to its customer, which is the external customer, it promises a committed service time of S1 days, and it requires some processing time called T1. I won't be thinking about lead times in terms of transit times in this model. I'll think of them as a processing time that happens at the stage, but they're really equivalent concepts. Now, when stage one places an order to stage two, it is going to receive that order S2 days later. And so the net lead time at a given stage is defined as the inbound lead time, the committed service time that got promised by the upstream stage, SI plus 1, plus TI, the processing time that happens at the stage, minus SI. And you can think of that as sort of bad lead time as the first two stages and good lead time as the second stage. Bad lead time in the sense that the longer that is, the harder life is on stage I, because that means that he has more time that he has to wait when he places an order until those items arrive and are processed and are ready for finished goods inventory. And SI is a good lead time in the sense that the longer SI is, that means I've promised my customer a longer lead time. And so the longer lead time I promise my customer, the less inventory I have to maintain myself. So it turns out that there's a very direct relationship between the net lead time and the inventory. So on slide 42, I give two extreme examples. So the biggest that SI can be is the inbound lead time plus the processing time. In other words, if the inbound lead time or committed service time is 4 and the processing time is 2, then for sure I don't need to quote a lead time that's longer than 6. 6 days is enough that I can place an order, receive the order, process the order, and give it to my customer within the committed service time without me holding any inventory whatsoever. In other words, I operate completely as a pull system or a make-to-order system or a just-in-time system. The other extreme is that I promise my customer a committed service time of 0. I promise you that when you come to my store, I will have however much product you demand in stock, ready to give to you immediately. And in that case, I operate as a make-to-stock system. And that's the other extreme value for SI. Now, in general, we can say that the amount of the base stock level that I need on slide 43 now is a reasonably straightforward function of the net lead time. Equal to mu times the net lead time plus sigma z alpha times the square root of the net lead time. And for those of you who are paying careful attention, you'll notice that this is the same formula as the optimal day stock level in the news vendor problem when I have positive lead times, except that instead of a lead time L, I've just replaced it with the net lead time NLT. And so choosing inventory levels is equivalent to choosing these NLTs. In other words, by setting the variables S at each stage, that determines all the net lead times, and that in turn determines all of the base stock levels. And so the inventory, the optimization problem works with S as the decision variable rather than Y. Okay, slide 44. The objective here is just to find all the optimal S values for the system, in other words, all of the committed service times, in order to minimize the expected holding cost. There's no penalty cost here, no stockout cost, because I'm assuming that I'm meeting all of the demands within the committed service time. And the only constraint is that I've promised some S to the end customer, which is non-negotiable. All the other S's are negotiable because those are internal to the supply chain, but the net lead time that I've promised to the end customer is a constraint. These problems turn out to be reasonably easy to solve, especially for serial systems and tree systems. Both of those can be solved with pretty straightforward dynamic programming approaches. And more general systems, in fact, even systems with cycles allowed, can be solved using a piecewise linear approximation and CPLEX, and that comes from a recent paper in 2006 by McNanty et al. And when I say CPLEX, I do mean CPLEX and not necessarily any commercial IP solver, because the success of this algorithm really relies on certain cuts that get added in the pre-processing stage of CPLEX that I think most of the other IP solvers haven't quite caught up with. So CPLEX is an important component of that algorithm. One key insight, slide 45 now, that comes from the results of this optimization problem is that it's usually optimal for only a few stages in the system to hold inventory, and all the other stages operate as pull systems. They hold no inventory. And in fact, we can say that in a serial system, every stage either holds no inventory and quotes the maximum committed service time, it operates as a pure pull system, or it quotes a CST of zero and holds the maximum inventory. In other words, every stage has, in a serial system, has one of the two extreme cases from slide 42. So the next couple of slides give a case study that just gives an example of how performing this kind of optimization can change the structure of inventory placement in a supply chain. And I think I won't go through this case study in detail except to say that the upshot is that to maintain a reasonable service level, you can often keep costs reasonably low. In other words, the trade-off is favorable in order to re-optimize your inventory and still maintain a good service level to the customer. Feel free to look through these slides in more detail afterwards, and this exact case study is also given in the Logic of Logistics book, second edition, by Simke Levy et al. One other thing I wanted to mention about this guaranteed service model is that this model has been implemented in commercial software. David Simke Levy has a company called Logic Tools that has a product that implements a generalization of this model. Steve Braves and Sean Willems, who wrote the paper in 2000, have a company called Optian that that has an implementation of this model. And I believe that Sridhar Tayor's SmartOps software, the inventory optimization that does, also uses this model as a starting point. So unlike most of the stochastic service models like Clark Scarf, this model is getting implemented in practice, and a lot of the commercial solvers that are out there for supply chain inventory optimization are using it or some variant of it. Okay, the last section is about decentralized systems, and basically the issue here is what happens if each of the stages wants to optimize its own profit instead of trying to optimize the profit of the whole supply chain. I talked about two issues related to that, but in the interest of time, I'll just skip those, let you look at that on your own, and of course, let me know if you have any questions. Slide 59 gives a bunch of textbooks and one book chapter that are good sources for further reading if you want to read more of that, and finally, slide 60, ask if you have any questions. We're also at minute approximately 60, so maybe there's not time for questions, but I'll let Ignacio moderate that.
Right. Well, thanks a lot, Larry, for a very nice overview, and we do have time for questions or comments. I guess, Larry, since you kind of whisked quickly on the latter part, can you maybe just sort of very briefly summarize what's the main message in those slides?
Sure, for the decentralized part?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so the first section talks about the suboptimality that can result from everybody trying to optimize their own profit. And what typically happens is that because of a concept called double marginalization, let's say there are two parties in a supply chain. I sell something to you, you buy it from me. So I decide how much to charge you, and you decide how much to order from me. If we make those decisions independently to maximize our own profits, then we will collectively achieve less than the best possible supply chain profit that we would achieve if we were owned by the same company trying to maximize our total profit. And so this is very common in lots and lots of situations. And so there's a very big body of literature now on so-called supply chain coordination or supply chain contracting, where the idea is that you and I impose some contract in place that splits the costs or the revenues or the risks or the rewards in a particular way, so that even when we both try to optimize our own profits, even when we both still act selfishly, we work in a way that achieves the maximum total profit. And all of this is based on game theory. The basic idea is that you're trying to put a contract in place so that the Pareto optimal solution equals the Nash equilibrium solution. If you're familiar with, for example, the prisoner's dilemma, the issue there is that those two are different solutions. And so by implementing a contract, you try to bring those two in line with each other. And then the other part is about the bullwhip effect, which is probably the most famous, topic in supply chain management. Basically, the idea there is that demand for a product, the variability amplifies as you move upstream, and I talk a little bit about some of the different causes of that. This is not an optimization issue. We're not talking here about how to optimize the bullwhip effect or anything like that, but it's a byproduct of inventory systems where players act independently instead of acting in concert to maximize the total profit of the supply chain, let's say. That was maybe less brief than you wanted, Ignacio.
No, that's okay. Just briefly, I guess on slide 56, where you have the figure of the bullwhip effect. As you mentioned, that as you start going downstream, the effect gets amplified. What are the things that one can do in order to reduce that typically? What controls do you have to reduce those peaks?
A bunch of things that have been studied in the literature. Some of them involve information sharing. One of the things that causes the bullwhip effect is sort of a misperception in one portion of the supply chain of what's happening in another portion of the supply chain. So players react to bad signals, and they react irrationally, or even if they react rationally. And so sharing information within the supply chain can reduce, although generally not eliminate, the bullwhip effect. Other causes of the bullwhip effect are things like fixed costs. So if there are big fixed costs to place orders, then players tend to batch their orders, and that leads to more variability. So reducing fixed costs reduces the bullwhip effect. Of course, everyone would love to reduce their fixed costs, and it's not always possible. But when it is possible to reduce them, one of the benefits of it is that the bullwhip effect is reduced. And there are a number of other mitigation strategies that have been proposed, and typically for each of the causes that have been proposed in the literature, there's a kind of strategy that helps to alleviate that.
Okay, thank you. Is there any question or comment out there? Okay. Well, again, thank you so much, Larry, for a very nice presentation. Again, we will be placing the presentation on the website, and we've also recorded, I guess, most of it, so hopefully you have that available, and we'll get back to you as to when we'll have the next CW seminar. We have now a number of things coming up, AICHE meeting and so forth, so it will be either early in December. If not, we'll defer it until early in January. Okay? So again, thanks very much for listening, and we'll be in touch. Okay. Thanks,
Thank you, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.